Part 3. Follow the directions. 7. Life defining the obvious. That's not natural. Between men and women, there is no friendship possible. There is passion, enmity, worship, love, but no friendship. Oscar Wilde. There exists selfish behavior that masquerades as love. This desire in disguise is either blooming or fading. It doesn't matter, as without maturity, it's selfish. Countless devastated relationships occur for no reason other than because the persons involved allowed selfish behavior to become the norm. Once the brain thinks this is normal, it will not sound the alarm, increasing the odds of its continuation. These are train wrecks waiting to happen because the driver is asleep. No one can or will stop the train. Only you can prevent train wrecks. One area in which I see this selfish behavior is in the human mating ritual. For the record, courtship and dating are not the same. Renting is to owning what dating is to courtship. They look the same, but the difference is in the commitment. If you hear of courtship and think about Mary living in a little house on the prairie or about John on Walton's Mountain in Schuyler, Virginia, you're thinking about courtship 100 years ago. Courtship is when you know what you need and are ready to put forth the effort not just to get it, but also keep it. Dating is not that. Like an impulse, unguided desire can lead to a train wreck or homelessness. Building a relationship is not easy. There are many stages. Not everyone is willing to apply the energy. That's a good thing to know up front. The Bible calls this separating the wheat from the chaff. The bank determines a potential borrower before offering a mortgage. It takes more than a cute smile. Couples and their family should also consider the future investment. In a way, the family is consigning. Dating is what you do when renting. You don't go to the bank. The house is gorgeous, the neighborhood is nice and convenient, and everything looks good. But the renter is not ready to commit to 30-year mortgage, taxes, maintenance, and all the other work. Not yet. Lifelong renters pretend they're homeowners. At one point in life, they plan to own a house, but things happened and they lost their direction. The execution of a plan depends on faith. If a plan fails to launch, there are two reasons. The first is that there are too many chiefs. The second is that there is too little faith. Bad doubt is to blame for a weakness of faith. A lack of confidence destroys plans quickly. A renter wants to see if the place has any problems before they commit. They call this rent-to-own in the leasing business. Dazed people love the rent-to-own option because it's halfway between owning and renting. It's like a 12-year engagement. Dating is rent-to-own. I'll stay if there are no major problems and nothing better comes along. Ownership is belonging. It has the characteristics of relational responsibility. Renters skirt the commitment of ownership by placing the responsibility on someone else. They live in the "it's not my problem" herd. The difference between the two is the attitude. Renters want to know who is responsible. Owners know who is responsible. You own it and you fix it, or not. It is your future. If you want to live in a broken house, go for it. Some people do choose to live in a broken house instead of fixing it. They stay until it is unbearable, and they leave the house in the dust. These are the renters pretending to be owners. They figure that buying a house is all that takes to be an owner. This is where their desire stops, at the possession stage. You own it, you fix it. That's no brainer. It speaks to the responsibility of taking care of stuff. An owner wants to fix it. Till death do them part is the assurance. It is the idea that this is mine, and I need to do the work to preserve it. The thought of having to pay for any repairs around the house and having to mow the lawn and shovel snow is enough to keep some people from ever owning a house. It scares them to doubt. Doubt lies somewhere between belief and disbelief. It involves confusion, distrust, and the lack of sureness of what you know, do, feel, or decide. At the end of a story without faith, nothing was ventured, so nothing is gained. Without investing in the future, there is no equity. For most people, ownership is the first real investment in building a future. It proves a faith in the future and a commitment to be greater than today. Even if that future is uncertain, it shows a commitment to persist. When asked, Couples tell how they felt when they became owners. Men answer with security, and women answer with comfort. Both of them agree. Life is more certain with a clear bearing. People of all ages say that buying a house seemed to complete adulthood for them. Many confessed an unawareness of the void until they became owners. Ownership shows your confidence and commitment to the future. That level of pride and commitment typically is not found among the more transient community of renters. The ability to get back as much as you put into the future is a major difference between renting and owning. Owning builds equity over time, security, and comfort. That equity is support in times of need. Renting doesn't build equity because there is no investment. No investment means a void of commitment. If there is a problem, it's not theirs. It makes it easier to walk and start again elsewhere. Some people like renting for this reason. That's good to know up front. By now, you have caught the drift. If not, replace ownership with courtship or marriage, and renting with dating or playing house. It may be tough getting the idea of owning your spouse out of your head. Thingamabob. Never let a fool kiss you, or a kiss fool you. Joey Adams. Dating is the norm, but not always. There was a time when courting was the norm and dating was the thingamabob. Expressing romantic feelings is the norm, no matter. How it's done and what the result is does matter. Doing it for pleasure only should not be the norm. Dating arrived on scene shortly after the mass production of the car. Prior to that, it happened within the family, and the name for it was courting. The car brought change to the frontier, and dating became a thingamabob adjustment. Bob and Sally now had a way to separate themselves from the family. Advance in technology alters herd behavior in an attempt to assimilate and adapt the new thingamabob into our life. For a taste of this, visit Lancaster and Philadelphia, which are both towns in Pennsylvania. The difference between them is that the Amish in Lancaster chose not to assimilate the thingamabobs. They live as they have, without the modern thingamabobs. Philadelphians, on the other hand, chose to assimilate and adapt change. The thingamabob, phone, car, TV, poodle skirt, and so forth, can be good, neutral, or bad. It has nothing to do with a thingamabob and everything to do with us. After all, a thingamabob is just a thingamabob. What we decide to do with it is our choice. Before the car, courtship was the means of securing a mate. My children cringe when I use the word mate. Nevertheless, that is the intent in a courtship. Expressing romantic feelings is a part of it, along with a mature understanding of the intent, and this leads to a lifetime commitment. The suitor is part of the family from the beginning. This makes sense, as eventually, they will become a member of the family. Therefore, it is foolish to alienate them. The couple displays to mom, dad, the siblings, and the grandparents on both sides of the family their commitment to preserve the relationship. The courtships usually take place in the open and within family activities. Doing so allows the soon-to-be family member a way to ease into the clan. This is an excellent screening. Any potential problems come to surface and get solved before the marriage. This also greatly increases the odds of success. Changes to the family herd require smooth assimilation or adapting. The better the transition, the greater the success of the family, survival. This new thingamabob turned relationships around, so long-term courtship gave way to short-term dating. Bob and Sally could now hide away from others. Isolation for self-indulgence is rarely a good thing. Put the words short-term and relationship together, and you get, it's not you. Dating is the art of breaking up with everyone you date, except for one. That one would be your husband or wife. When a breakup occurs, it is an experience of emotional divorce. It is not uncommon that when a person finally marries, it feels like they went through 5 divorces. Call me an orange-bellied parrot, but it seems to me like courting is more conducive to the survival of the human herd. I do not see the advantage of going through 5 emotional divorces before marriage, unless dating is meant to be an emotional boot camp that can toughen up the relationship weenies so they can just learn to move on. Or is the purpose of dating to rent before buying? Try it before you buy it, or take it home for the weekend to see if you like it, and then we'll talk. Dating becomes a fun thing to do until the right one comes along, like fishing. It is a game of catch and release until one is good enough to bring home. There is one problem. If you have the one on the line, the right one gets away. How do you meet someone? That's a rhetorical question. I assume you don't or didn't date everybody that introduced themselves to you. Most people go out with a group of friends a few times before they meet someone. Dating starts by a mutual agreement to be exclusive. This is a minimum requirement. Without an exclusive agreement, it's not even called dating. Dating and courting assumes expressing romantic feelings. If there is no romantic or sexual expression, then it's called hanging out with friends. In the absence of a non-exclusive arrangement, what is the point? The non-exclusive intimate arrangement typically involves money. If there is no plan to be exclusive and or marry, what is it? There are other ways to meet the one without trying out several. Relationships do not end in marriage, but some of them become so intimate and intense that couple looks like they're married. Many refer to this as a common law marriage. Some think time equals strength in a relationship, which in turn equals marriage. I am going to take a short detour. This detour is to clear up wrong ideas of common law marriage in the United States. First, common law marriage is not so common. Only 15 states and D.C. recognize the arrangement. Alabama, Colorado, District of Columbia, Georgia, Idaho, Iowa, Kansas, Montana, New Hampshire, Ohio, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, South Carolina, Texas, and Utah. A common law marriage has four basic features. 1. A present agreement to be married. The happy couple must announce to each other that they consider themselves married from a specific time forward. Specific words are not needed, but they would be nice. Evidence of an agreement to marry is needed to show a mutual understanding. 2. Cohabitation. They must actually live together. 3. Public representations of marriage. The couple must consistently hold themselves out to the public as married. A married couple tells people that they are married, and so should a common law couple. 4. They should also file joint tax returns and declare their marriage on other documents, such as applications, leases, and birth certificates. The University of Chicago, aka Where Fun Goes to Die, examined data from the National Survey of Families and Households. What they found is that marriage is good. Married couples are generally more financially well off than couples who simply live together. The reason is that married couples have the habit of pooling money and investing in the future than couples who merely live together. This is equity of ownership. What you put in, you get back. Money alone is not a reason to marry, but marriage does have a better benefit package, like medical care, safer surroundings, better food, and other things that raise the standard of living and lessen stress. And yes, it is true. Married people report having more and better sex. Courting went to Ford with the arrival of that thingamabob. Courting became dating because with mass production, the suitor had a car. The couple left the family in the dust. Separating meant privacy, but it also opens the door to danger. Parents' legal obligations are the three S's: safety, security, and support for their children. Most parents would not let their teenager go out with a stranger, but this happens every weekend. The Center for Family Justice reports that a third of all rapes are of women between the ages of 14 to 17. Many date because they don't know how to be single. Others date for enjoyment. Dating for marriage is courtship, and it involves the family. If you are dating someone who is not the one, and the one shows up, you're not available because you're dating someone else. At best, dating is a dazed courtship. It can go either way. Most of the time, dating is for selfish reasons. But we pretend it is to form romantic feelings, to find that someone. Don't be fooled. The romantic feelings formed before the first date. If not, there would not be a date. The date is romantic desire in action. It makes sense that half of all marriages end in divorce because the couple has more practice in divorce than in marriage. Just say no. Don't worry that children never listen to you. Worry that they are always watching you. Robert Fulghum. Let me tell you about two people, a 20-year-old woman and a 16-year-old man. They are my daughter Brianna and my son Elijah. At 20, Brianna has never dated. As a result, she has many friends, both male and female. Her male relationships are not romantic in any form, yet. Despite her brother's opinion, there does not appear to be any long-term psychological damage from not dating. Our family is a date-free zone. At 18, Brianna logically decided that if he is not my husband-to-be, then I don't need to be expressing romantic desire. This makes sense. Indeed, why would anyone? So she chose to extend the dating embargo. From what I see, the lack of a boyfriend did not negatively impact her social life. It did just the opposite. It allowed Brianna the freedom to dance through the dating minefield unharmed. She is actually the medic her friends cry out for when a relationship blows up. My son Elijah is another story. He knows the right thing to say and do, intellect, but his hormones don't agree, desire. Because of his struggle between thought and action, he is on a shorter leash than his sister. This means his mother and I keep an eye out for potential landmines. Our attempt to keep him out of harm's way does not go unnoticed. At each opportunity to moan the social injustice, the message is the same. I've done nothing to cause you to distrust me, but you do. He then follows up with a rationalization. How can I earn your trust unless you give me a chance? By dating. The issue has little to do with Elijah and a lot to do with dating. It places adolescents in crisis situations that can lead to serious damage. Teenagers find it difficult to interrupt an action that is underway. For example, they have trouble stopping something amid doing it, like speeding, or thinking before acting, like knowing how deep the water is before diving. It is the inability to choose between safer and riskier alternatives. It is easy to say they will not get into a car with a drunk driver, but it is more difficult to turn down the invitation in practice. If they wait till it's time to change their mind, they waited too long. Keep in mind that the brain we rely on to make adult choices is about 16 years old. The flowchart has just begun. My belief that teenage dating is destructive comes from experience. My dating had nothing to do with my wife, who I married 15 years later. It did bring much drama, which is good, because every teenager needs more drama. This was enough evidence for Brianna. Elijah wanted to take it a trial. For him, not dating was a punishment for a crime not yet committed. Elijah is the judge of the family because he possesses a keen sense of justice. So in his mind, receiving unwarranted punishment is a clear violation of his civil rights. This violation triggered a passionate debate. Everyone dates in his world. So he figured that our opposition to dating must have had something to do with him. He needed to see what teen dating was. He needed proof beyond doubt. Taking apart the ritual of dating needed tools. And there is no better tool than the internet. In the midst of gathering ammo to destroy dating, I stumbled on a website on teen dating. The expert did a fabulous job of clarifying the hazards of dating. It was fabulous because while it showed the benefits of dating, it made obvious its inherent flaws as well. When it comes to dating, the cons far outweigh the pros. By approaching Elijah with the pros of dating from a website so beautifully flawed, I flanked him. He still wants to date, but now understands our objection to dating. Indeed, he is the judge because if he understands the law, he will follow it even if he desires something different. The site made an assumption. That assumption is that teens are adults, and it split dating into two groups, teen and adults. This is a big mistake, as this is a major flaw with all adult behaviors. For the record, dating is an adult behavior. Teens are not adults. I think half of adults are not adults. Society tells kids that they are adults at 18. An 18-year-old brain is not a mature brain. 18 has more to do with graduating high school than being an adult. My guess is that if only primary education were required, adulthood would start at 14. Adulthood is not based on age. It is based on maturity. It seems that adults date for securing a life partner or sex. I would have never guessed. If dating is for marriage or sex, why do teens date? According to teens and this website, it is about honing social skills. I would make a joke about this absurd definition of teens dating if I were not a father. Dating is about marriage, pretend marriage, or sex. Unless you're planning your teenager's wedding, the social skills they are honing is a euphemism for sex. I want to shed a little light on this euphemism we casually use when talking about teen dating. The Center for Disease Control tracks teen pregnancy. In 2011, a total of 329,799 babies were born to women aged 15 to 19 years old. That's the bad news. The good news is that this is a record low of U.S. teens. In 2009, 784,507 legal-induced abortions were reported to CDC for women aged 15 to 44 years old. The majority was women in their 20s. That's the bad news. The good news, according to research, is that about a quarter of the long-term decline in pregnancies, births, and abortions are due to reduced sexual activity among women aged 15 to 17. When they say abstinence doesn't work, I say, show me the numbers. Continuation of the species is about survival, and it is natural. Abortion and unwanted teen pregnancies are obstructions to survival. They're just not natural. Homework. What is dating? What is courting? Which has greater benefits? Which requires greater effort? What is your opinion of how human behavior changes to incorporate a thingamabob? What thingamabobs do you like? What thingamabobs do you dislike? Does any thingamabob influence your behavior? Is it controllable? How do you control the influence? Which do you prefer, dating or courting? Why? 8. Where are you going? It's really over. There is a rhythm to ending of a marriage just like the rhythm of courtship, only backward. You try to start again, but get into blaming over and over. Finally, you are both worn out, exhausted, hopeless. Then the lawyers are called in to pick clean the corpse. The death occurred much earlier. Erica Jong. As a marriage and family therapist, my living comes from joining people in their troubles. On some days, it is a tough way to make a living. The hard part of the job is not the problems. I am trained for that. It's the people. My job as a psychotherapist places me in a peculiar spot. I enjoy analyzing human behavior, but not so much the human. I imagine physicians encounter the same peculiarity. They choose their field of study because of a fascination of human biology and the desire to make a difference. After school, they come out equipped to tackle the ailments of the human body, but not so much the human being. A common truth is that most fatalities are preventable, if not for the human getting in the way. The design allows for a moral compass, soul, to influence rational thought, intellect, to dictate appropriate action, will. Trouble occurs when that design is used irresponsibly. That is the reason governments feel compelled to rule human behavior. If we all stuck to the plan, decisions would be made based on morals and the actions that follow would be noble. Forget about love. Maybe that is too lofty a goal. How about we set the bar at good? We've got the tools. I'm sure we can be good. We can fix a few loose nuts, and I bet we could do it. Free will is the ability to use the design freely. This is what I do for a living. I am a design instructor. When a doctor discovers that a patient's cholesterol level is high, he informs the patient and the need for change in order to avoid the risks. Biologically, the patient hears the doctor, but somehow, intellectually, he is not listening to the message. A year later, the first mild heart attack occurs. Finally, the doctor's message gets through. Pain has a way of getting our attention. The diet and exercise last for another year before signs of returning desire whisper doubt in the patient's ear. Did you really have a heart attack? It's been over a year now, and your cholesterol is under control. Because of doubt and weakness of character, the next 6 years are spent going back and forth between do's and don'ts. Despite the family's and the doctor's urgings, a consistent healthy routine never happens. 7 years from the initial warning, the fatal heart attack occurred. Not heeding a warning is flirting with temptation. It's fine, but only if you are prepared to lose. There comes a time when opportunity is no more. Typically, the moment of change fades without notice. Awareness does occur in the end as a painful reminder that it's too late. The story as written is the story on record with no more opportunity for change. The good doctor and I have something in common in that we both see a crash before it occurs. Despite the warnings, a third ignored us. Another third are waiting for something. With this said, in my world of train wrecks, I am invited on board just before the fatal movement. You may ask, why wait until you know the train is going to crash? That's a good question, to which the answer is, good question. What's even more surprising is that lawyers and pastors get called to the scene first, for opposite reasons. I guess they are there to hedge the bet. I imagine myself as an ER doctor with defibrillator paddles in hand yelling, clear, waiting for the mangled relationships to come back to life. I have an explanation for this wasting away of the heart, but the short answer is, if you wait till it's time for a therapist, you waited too long. When arriving on the scene, the first task is to get an assessment of the damage. I feel the pain of not only the doctor, but of the traffic cop investigating an accident. Nobody gives any information for fear of self-incrimination. As a marriage therapist, this deflection of responsibility comes in the form of blaming the spouse, the kids, and the dog for their unhappiness. This is the extent of their responsibility to the crash. If the family hadn't pissed me off, we'd have never crashed. Recognize the don't habit? Finger pointing may have something to do with a train crashing. So instead of the ER doc with a defibrillator, I am a cop with pen and paper trying to write the facts while they argue who is at fault. No one believes it as a no-fault world, but we pretend just in case. Heaven forbid anyone should be responsible. Who's driving? Immature love says, I love you because I need you. Mature love says, I need you because I love you. Erich Fromm. Most hearts stop around the 10th year. In 1950, warring couples had to show a fault such as abandonment, cruelty, incurable mental illness, or adultery before pronouncing the marital death. Can you imagine? You had to actually give a legitimate reason. That's like, I don't know, taking responsibility. Luckily, we're not in the 50s. It seems we have evolved beyond responsibility. It is no longer needed in a no-fault world. This means that if you're not happy, no worries, just throw it away. In a no-fault world, there is no commitment as long as everyone is happy. It's weird, but I see fewer and fewer happy people these days. There is a problem with ignoring responsibility. You can't. In a country of intolerable toleration, it makes sense. We tolerate intolerant intolerance until it's no longer tolerable. No fault implies escaping consequence for action. It is ironic that in this no-fault world, the human wilderness is full of fault finders. It makes the irony even more delicious. To make the irony even more delicious, the last frontier is one of the easiest places to end the marital journey. The good news is that, in order to file for divorce, every state has at least a residency requirement. In Wyoming, you have to live there for a whole 6 weeks. Even in Las Vegas, Sin City, the residency requirement is 8 weeks. The bad news, which is sort of funny, is that in Alaska, the requirement is met with a valid fishing license. Think bubble and spirit circle for a moment. The most effort is given to the highest priority. Sometimes problems occur for no other reason than a misalignment of priorities. Higher education is a top priority for a lot of wide-eyed people looking to make a difference. So that means every effort is made to see to it that everyone has a chance to achieve a college degree. For a University of Alaska aspiring graduate, the price tag is $31,061 per year. If our college hopeful moves to the last frontier for 2 years, the price tag drops to $6,650,000 per year. That shows that Alaska is serious about higher education. When you physically reside in the state for 2 years to demonstrate commitment, or when you have a parent or grandparent that graduated from college in Alaska, the state drops the price tag by $24,411, 80%. That is the kind of effort needed for change. Unfortunately, there must have been a misalignment or someone must have missed the memo. It is easier to qualify for a divorce than it is to qualify for in-state tuition. I am not advising Alaska to change their in-state tuition requirement. Maybe they just need to add a fishing license waiver. A no-fault divorce is a thingamabob, a mutation that developed over the last 5 decades due to an overabundance of apathy in the environment, I dare say, Mr. Spencer, that we are devolving into noncommittal people. The herd is breaking up, and no one is at fault. This equals to no responsibility. No responsibility means no ownership. No ownership means no effort. And no effort means no more change. A lack of commitment makes a no-fault world a world of finger-pointers. It's mayhem. Run for the hills. The bad news about mass delusion is that everyone believes the lie. In order to evade personal responsibility, someone has to be at fault. Get it? The good news is that our world is a responsible one, and we are responsible people. The problem is that a third doesn't see any need for change, and another third isn't sure. In psychology, maturity is the ability to respond to your environment and your community in an appropriate manner. This response is generally learned rather than instinctive. In other words, we get our clues from those around us. It is called knowing the rules of correct behavior for certain times and places. This includes knowing when to act according to the norms and values of the society you live in. If you don't like where you're at, chances are you're not following the rules, and you think that everyone else is wrong. The quality of decision-making is a barometer of maturity. Keep this in mind the next time you choose. Bob and Sally. Any cause or activity needs commitment. When you have it, everyone can see it. If not, there is a problem. Belonging produces commitment. It is true for the soldier as well as the spouse. The problem of commitment is the same as responsibility. Either you are or you are out. Either you're part of the solution or you're part of the problem. If you are not going to be involved in fixing the problem, which is your prerogative, shut up and sit down. This is the universal story of Bob and Sally. It began with an idea. Marriage. Bob took Sally to be his wife. He swore an oath to have and to hold her from that day forward. For better or worse, for richer or poorer, in sickness and in health was the promise. The two would love and cherish each other until death did them part. I know what you're thinking. This is only a ritual, a symbolic ceremony. The oath is predetermined according to custom. Besides, it's not like the Pledge of Allegiance or an oath to defend the Constitution. Unfortunately, half of all people feel this way. You are not swearing to a life of rainbows and cotton candy. You are swearing to loyalty. Do not be a hypocrite. If you can't keep your word, then shut up and sit down. Unfortunately, Bob and Sally are hypocrites. Without exercise and proper care, and after 7 years of marriage, their hearts began to harden. The unhappy couple waited until they needed a therapist. There was just enough time for an assessment of the damage. A head gently sways side to side with a pronouncement of the marital death. After the first fatal marital heart attack, there is an oath to not remarry. 3 years later, it will fade the same as the first. They're not to blame. The desire to have someone to hold from this day forward is part of the plan. The having and holding part sounds pleasant. This is the extent of the selfish desire. It does not extend to anyone but one person. It takes two to marry, but only one to divorce. There is no sense, common or uncommon, in divorce. From here, the oath is for better or for worse, as long as your better is more than my worst. For richer or poorer for a while, but selfish people don't do poor. The in sickness and in health part has the same rider as the money issue. Then the couple promises to love and to cherish each other until the loving fades. This is not the plan. It is a mutation of the design. The design is an innate feeling to be in a relationship. It is the desire to be responsible. The responsibility is the effort to improve. To be more is the plan. It requires a will, not to survive but to thrive. The second marriage took place the same as the first, with a promise of lasting love. There is a 70% chance that this rodeo will last for 11 years. 7 years into the second marriage, the hearts began to harden as before. It was a very bad sign because it meant that past mistakes did nothing to prevent future ones. Thus, mistakes keep repeating. I asked Bob and Sally one question. What do you know? Translation. Tell me you've learned something. If the answer was nothing, there was another nod of the head as I pronounced the death of marriage number two. At this point, Bob and Sally are 21 years older and hopefully a little wiser. If, after nearly 25 years and two failed marriages, They believe that the third time is the one and they decide to remarry, the odds put their marriage's survival at 5 years. At 50, Bob and Sally have been married and divorced 3 times. This shows a couple with a desire for something that is missing and that eludes them, mature love. With more than half of life behind them, their friends are celebrating their silver wedding anniversaries. This is painful. The sad irony is that divorce is viewed as a means to avoid pain, but it creates more pain. This is the opposite of survival. This is premature death. The desire for the relationship is part of the design. The problem with desire is in the lack of a commitment for more. What was designed as perfect from the beginning is marginalized and mutated into a disposable no-fault commitment. The plan has no room for indecision. Either you're in or you're out. The risk factor for marital sclerosis is not fatty food. It is differences of opinion. Who would guess that differences of opinions and ideas would stop the heart? Arguments about kids, money, and sex are the number one cause of marital sclerosis. Like atherosclerosis, the argument slowly adds plaque to the lining of the marital heart. This plaque is in the form of unresolved tension that slowly cuts off the lifeblood. Another similarity of both heart diseases is that the symptoms go unnoticed. At least with atherosclerosis, you may go a few decades before your first heart attack. Marital heart attacks occur within the first decade. Relationship goals. The productivity of a work group seems to depend on how the group members see their own goals in relation to the goals of the organization. Ken Blanchard. Nobody I meet enters an agreement with the thought that things will be worse. If they do, the problem is not the agreement, it's them. Any agreement is typically mutually beneficial. This is the idea behind connecting to others for the purpose of support, and this is called networking. It is applied in all types of situations for all types of reasons. Why? Because we are greater when we are connected. United we stand, divided we fall. I know this is nothing new, but I am still waiting for a third or so to do something. I understand but do not like it when people say, I love XYZ, but I'm not in love. You evidently still love XYZ, but are not in love. This in is translated as, and that's the reason. Most often, dot 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 makes less sense than I love XYZ, but I'm not in love. It is hard for me to grasp how one's involvement with XYZ went from the best thing ever to the worst in just a year. It sounds so Hollywood, like saying it needs no further explanation. Love is not something you fall in and out of like a pool. If it is, then there's no love, period. What the person saying it really conveys is that XYZ made me happy, but not so much now. Love is a complex emotion that deserves consideration. It is a rule of responsibility to one another to ensure survival. There is an exception to every rule. The exception to this rule is the trickster. This person has a selfish agenda, and he often looks for a target. 2/3 of us do not intentionally harm others. The other third is the exception. This is when XYZ turns out to be a sociopath hybrid. Barring the exception to the rule, most relationships have life-changing potential for good. In general, a choice is made on the facts at the time with no foreknowledge. This means that you should not spend time rehashing the choices you made because nothing can be done about them, unless you own a time machine. Do not waste time comparing the present with the past. Whether it's military or marriage, a commitment is a leap of faith. That's not a good thing. No one should settle for a commitment that lacks faith. The ones jumping show others the belief in the integrity of the team and plan. The ones not jumping show doubt. Choosing XYZ was the best thing ever, period. Stop here because nothing learned after choosing XYZ was available. So you would not have chosen differently. This thinking is part of the universal delusion that responsibility can be avoided. Misplaced guilt comes in part from the delusional thinking that foreknowledge was available. This foreknowledge would have changed decisions that would have thus changed the outcome. This only happens in sci-fi. The term for this thought is counterfactual thinking. Psychology explains that humans need to create possible endings to life events that have already occurred to relive the anxiety of their choices. They create the ending because the real ending, the one that already happened, causes pain. K. Counterfactual is counter to the facts. These thoughts consist of the what-ifs and the if-onlys. Counterfactual thoughts are fantasy. They can never occur without a time machine. They solely pertain to events that have occurred in the past. There seems to be a link between this and the nightmares of regret. Do not be seduced by counterfactual thinking. If counterfactual thinking gets traction, it causes doubt, which in turn cripples future decision-making and shuts down problem-solving. What happens is a rehashing of past events. This rehashing either causes people to take on too much responsibility or not enough. The next times choose differently, and still, there is no guarantee of the outcome. The fantasy of how things would be is only a fantasy. There are two problems with fantasy. One, they are always better than reality. And two, they are not real. The best choice is made with careful consideration. Or is it? If not, follow up the worst thing ever with a disclaimer telling the danger of the improper use of the tools. Responsibility does not like it when you ignore her. You can do it, but it will cost you. If you fell out of love or XYZ turns into the worst thing ever, or if there are no sociopaths to blame, responsibility may be trying to say something. A vast majority of agreement is based on mutual satisfaction. Whether it is egotistic or altruistic doesn't really matter. Psychological egoism, doing something for others because it benefits you, is neither good or bad. It depends on the actions or motives of the actor. A good person seldom makes a good choice for a bad reason, but they do make bad choices for good reasons. Likewise, a bad person seldom makes a bad choice for a good reason, but they will make a good choice for a bad reason. If in the process of doing something for you, I benefit, it's called a win-win situation. On the other hand, if your benefit comes at my expense, I know what's coming. Human ego is neither good nor bad on its own. It is designed potential, depending on how you choose to use it. The goal of the connection is that we both improve. If I bring my car to the mechanic and he fixes it, I am satisfied. I feel better and pay for the repairs. The mechanic is satisfied. This mutual satisfaction comes from relational responsibility. Simply, if I am part of the herd, I am responsible for my actions in the herd. When everyone focuses on their own actions and reactions and not others, everyone is satisfied. The agreement throughout the herd is based on everyone playing by the rules. Understand that one-third doesn't play by the rules. Visit my office, and you will find that two things are apparent. The first thing is that I don't dust. Second, many of my stories come from my experiences of life and people. This is a pizza story that has less to do with pizza and more to do with relational responsibility. It is a responsibility to form and keep a relationship, like customers. One summer day in Rhode Island, while they were playing in the ocean at Brenton Point, the kids smelled pizza. My kids have the nose of a bloodhound when it comes to food. The aroma of food triggers a primal urge in them to eat. Call it natural selection or survival of the fittest, but it must be satisfied or else. Being on the receiving end of a food-induced zombie stare is disturbing, especially if Dad left the wallet at home. I often get the baffled, "but you are in charge" look, which momentarily gives me the feeling of inadequacy and which then quickly changes to fear. The fear is in the knowledge of the kids joyfully relaying the day's events to Mom. The no-money-for-food blunder gets repeated like a game-losing fumble. My brains scanned all possible choices and outcomes. Having only 3 wrinkled dollars, I fell back to the safety of a tried and tested move. Bribery. Parenting is like playing chess. Having played enough parent chess, I maneuvered situations well. The offer of a dollar to each seemed to do the trick. The youngest two looked the offer until the oldest tipped them off. Being wise to the ploy, she convinced her younger siblings to hold out for more. Sadly, when it comes to pizza, solidarity against Dad trumps sibling rivalry. I assumed the pawn position in the search of pizza. In the midst of the quest, the 8-year-old who reads everything saw a sign and screamed, "Free pizza tomorrow!" With great relief, I praised homeschooling and announced, "Tomorrow, we eat all the pizza in Newport." The next morning, having narrowly escaped the day before, I grabbed the wallet. My fate would not hinge on a sign. The minions retraced the steps to claim the pizza prize. It was remarkably empty for free pizza. This was my first hint that something didn't smell right. We sat down, and the kids excitedly asked about the free pizza. I figured that the pizza was free, but that the drinks were $6. The owner slightly asked what the sign said, to which they replied in unison, "Free pizza tomorrow." He smiled. "Silly kids. Today is not tomorrow," he said as he handed us menus. After seeing the prices, I mentioned to the sign and the empty restaurant and said, "Bad business." I took the kids across the street to the owner's competitor, who advertised free drinks. We drank for free and ate pizza. The kids were happy. I was happy. As I tipped the waitress and paid the bill, the owner was happy. The moral of the story is that relationships need responsible consideration. It just makes sense. You cannot escape the responsibility of tomorrow by evading it today. Abraham Lincoln. Homework. What feelings motivate you? By which are you moved more, positive or negative feelings? What role does or should a moral compass play in feeling management? From which do you learn better, positive or negative experiences? List three priorities for another person. If you found $1,000, what would you think first? Second, what does the Abe Lincoln quote mean? There is a 5-to-1 ratio for feeling attachment. Do something nice and get a dollar. Do something bad and pay $5. Sometimes the best motivation is the motivation not to do the wrong thing. At the end of the day, you're a lot richer.